Representative Samuels, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramirez. It is 5 minutes after 2. Our intention was to take up three bills today, but we received word from Representative Johansson that he wanted to hold House Bill 355 pending a clean CS. So we have before us CS for House Bill 103. We did not close public testimony. We have some folks that want to testify on this bill. We're going to proceed right to public testimony. Thank you very much. Emily Ninon, please, from the American Cancer Society. Are you with us, Emily? Okay. All right, let's see if she comes back on. And Meg Simonian, please.
Yes, this is Meg Simonian.
Thank you, Meg. If you'll proceed with your testimony, we've been joined by Representative Grunberg. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Meg Simonian. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I'm an attorney who practices in Anchorage, Alaska. I work for a firm that does primarily insurance bad faith cases, but we also do contract disputes and other disputes. I'm calling in order to testify against passing HB 103. I know that this body and bodies around the country, and including our Congress, has spent a great deal of time trying to curb the incidence of frivolous lawsuits. And I think that maybe unwittingly, this bill sets up a system of frivolous appeals. And I think that it is a dangerous precedent to set. And maybe the body doesn't understand or perceive how troubling this can be for litigants. I read through the materials that were available from the sponsor, and there seems to be a focus on the idea that this would only affect plaintiffs who lose. So the idea being that only plaintiffs who have lost would appeal, or plaintiffs who have won and defendants who lose would appeal. But actually, you know, this is going to affect any losing party in a dispute. And what it does is it sets up a system where the person who loses after a trial gets to appeal without having to post a bond that matches the amount of the judgment. And I think that the problem with that is recognized in the fiscal note that while it's zero, the Department of Law said that there will be a significant fiscal impact, but they just can't calculate it. And the reason that is because there's going to be a great deal of post-trial litigation that this sort of process sets out, because there really isn't a process. And what I mean by that is there seems to be an assertion by the sponsor and by some of the supporters that this protects people who have won at trial, because it protects them if the loser tries to hide assets or tries to dissipate assets in order to avoid paying the judgment. But there's nothing in this bill that creates a mechanism for making sure that happens. And so what the reality of an appeal is that it lasts for many years. And since there's no mechanism in this for really figuring out how, if a company is truly hiding assets or getting rid of assets in order to avoid paying a judgment, it essentially puts the burden on the person who won at trial to keep track of that without any sort of process set up to do that. I don't think it's needed at all, because there is discretion in the trial courts, and the trial courts have the discretion to lessen the amount on appeal as well as to increase it, and that's something that isn't recognized by the sponsor or in any of the supporting documents. So what that means is, a judge, if a company didn't have the assets to post the bond on appeal and could potentially face bankruptcy in order to do it, they could go to the trial court and say, we can't post this bond. Could you, within your discretion, lessen the bond so that we can appeal? And the other point I want to make about this is that, you know, this applies with equal force to business disputes. And the examples that were cited in some of the material that I think each member has before for it are three examples of businesses that, after the trial or after the litigation came out badly for them, were forced into bankruptcy. None of those involved personal injury or regular plaintiff versus a company type situation. Those are companies versus other companies. So what that means is when you're a business that has a contract dispute, say, with another business with, you know, equal accents, this bill will weight the playing field in favor of the losing party so that they have every reason in the world to appeal, even when or if they don't have a true legal meritorious reason to do so. So I don't know that the business community was, that this was explained to the business community, that it could in fact end up hurting the business community because they'll be tied up in litigation in the appellate process even when the appeal doesn't have merit.
Thank you very much, Meg. Are there questions for Ms. Monian? Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Monian. Do you have a copy of the e-version, the work draft proposed CS?
You know, I don't. Representative Grunberg, I just looked online and got what I could off of the legislative information site. I didn't see the committee substitute.
Okay, well, there's a proposed committee substitute. I'm sorry you don't have it. But it's the same language. I'm interested. Page 3, line 5. I'm sorry, line 6, the term dissipating assets. Dissipation implies some kind of an active, whether intentional or negligent, action on the part of the appellant. Suppose the company is just falling into hard times and can foresee that, but is doing nothing to actively dissipate the assets. This bill would apply rather than having the exception apply.
Rather.
Isn't that correct? And so, basically, the judgment could become worthless even though the appellant is not, quote, intentionally dissipating. Even if it's negligent, it doesn't have to be an intentional dissipation.
Well, that's always the case. I mean, if you have a judgment against you, which is one of the reasons I caution the body against these claims that this, you know, without this bill, people will go into bankruptcy because they can't afford the appeal bond. I mean, the bottom line is that sometimes companies go into bankruptcy because they can't afford to pay the judgment that a jury has said they owe, whether that's to an individual or to another company. That happens sometimes. I think the idea that that aspect of the bill somehow protects the party that won at trial is illusory. That there's no mechanism, just by saying that if a party can prove by preponderance of the evidence that a company is intentionally dissipating assets, they can force that company to post a bond. Just by saying that without also providing some sort of practical mechanism for that to happen doesn't provide any protection at all. And that's what I mean. I mean, how is a person who's gone to trial, paid the expense of going to trial, won at trial, whatever the dispute may be, whether it's a contract dispute or a real estate dispute, so they've won, a jury has said that they are entitled to this, supposed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the party that lost is now trying to hide or dissipate their assets in order to avoid the judgment. There's no way to just prove that. I mean, that's implicit in the idea of hiding or disguising assets, which is why the bond is as it is now. So whatever that jury said that person owes or that company owes has to be protected in order for that person to pursue an appeal, the losing party to pursue an appeal. So it's a built-in fairness to secure what is owed to another party.
Mr. Chair.
That would be stripped away, basically. And
yep.
So, in a way, you're right. I mean, if they aren't actively, intentionally trying to dissipate their assets, this doesn't protect them, them being the winning party.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ms. Simonian, through the chair.
This vocational group.
There is a litigable issue of, quote, intentional dissipation, and if the appellee bears the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. Isn't that, in essence, an action for fraud within the main action. Aren't those basically the elements you have to prove to show a fraudulent transfer?
I'd say you're probably right. That's true.
And I don't know if you've ever had to litigate a fraudulent transfer case, but I have, and they're very hard to win.
Well, they're very hard to prove, right? I mean, and that is the point, is that in order to protect the judgment, you would have to litigate a separate case. So you would be, in essence, by passing this legislation, you would be imposing a whole new level of litigation on both parties, which I don't think anybody has really thought out in terms of anybody. I mean, the people who are saying they support this. So it's adding another layer of litigation, and you're right, it is essentially a fraudulent transfer case, you know, and it's the same standard of proof, a preponderance of the evidence. So, I mean, it's adding that whole layer, which is why I think the Department of Law in its fiscal note said, we can't tell you how much this is going to cost, but it's going to have a significant impact, because it will require this extra layer of litigation. And anybody would have to, I mean, in order to access all of that sort of information that isn't public information, it would have to be in the context of litigation.
You done, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, for the moment. Thank you.
Ms. Simonian, I can't help but just let the members know that Victor Schwartz is on the line, who joined us last week. Ms. Simonian, I can't help but see the letters of support that are in our respective files.
Yes.
State Chamber, NFIB, Alaska Trucking Association, Cabaret Hotel Restaurant Retailers, Alaska Restaurant Beverage Owners, Flint Hills, a couple of general contractors. What does this collective group not get?
I think what they don't under... I think perhaps it was sold to them as, this is tort reform, and as a business community, we should support tort reform, and this will make it easier for a business who is lost against a plaintiff to appeal a case, which is true. The other part of that story is that this will make it easier for a business that has won against another business for a contract dispute. It will make it easier for that business that lost to make a frivolous appeal. And, you know, the idea that there are these multi-million dollar judgments out there that will drive businesses into bankruptcy if they want to exercise the right to appeal, I think the only context for that I can give you is last year, I think I'm safe in saying the biggest judgment that was issued in the state of Alaska after a trial was the John Ellsworth and Siri case. I'm sure some of you followed that case, or at least read about it in the newspaper. That's a typical case that results in a multi-million dollar judgment. And that case had the jury awarding both sides sums of, you know, millions of dollars in money. Now, in this situation, if this bill had been passed and this rule was in effect then, what this rule would mean is that one of those two parties would be allowed to appeal the case, appeal the decision of the jury, without posting a bond that was the amount of the judgment against them. So I don't think that the business community, I mean, I'm not really sure how this bill was initiated, and perhaps Representative Cobb, I mean, I assume it was from this tort reform group, but in that situation, the business community should be just as worried about this change as anybody, because it will hurt the business community. The winning side on the business dispute is going to be hurt by a change like that. And then, so that's what I'm saying they don't get. For instance, you know, if you own a business, a hotel, and you sue another company for defaulting on a contract that you have with it, and you win, that company, regardless of the merits of the appeal, would be allowed to appeal without posting a bond in the amount of the judgment. And it would be on your shoulders, your business's shoulders, to not only litigate the appeal, but then also litigate whether or not this company is trying to hide assets to avoid paying the money they owe you because they defaulted on their contract. So I think in that sense, that's not what those letters of support, those people who are supporting this bill maybe didn't understand that, those implications. And I read through some of those letters, and it seemed to me that some of them were under the impression that that people's right to trial was somehow infringed, and that this change would make it easier for a person to exercise their right to trial. And that's just a misunderstanding. I mean,
well, with all due respect, Ms. Simonian, as a person in the private sector, then I fundamentally misunderstand this bill, because that's precisely the way I get it. And I appreciate your point of view. Representative Coghill has a question for you.
Okay.
Pass.
Representative Grunberg.
The language setting the amount of the bond may not exceed the lesser amount of $5 million or 10% of all appellant's net worth.
Mm-hmm.
Customarily, in a case in which punitive damages are not at issue, where the net worth of the company may be an issue, at the point of trial, up to the time of judgment, do you normally do discovery on the other side's net worth? Is that normal, part of the normal discovery, or will this involve a whole new layer of post-trial discovery?
Well, at least absolutely post-trial discovery. I mean, you would never know a company's net worth unless a jury has decided that punitive damages are appropriate. So you don't even get to do discovery about a net worth until a jury has decided punitive damages are appropriate. And at that time, that which would be during the trial, so they've already decided that the company's liable and they've already decided punitive damages are appropriate, then the discovery of the net worth of the company would kick in. If punitive damages weren't at issue, then absolutely, it would require, like I said, a whole other layer of litigation in order to determine whether $5 million or the company's 10% of the company's net worth is less.
May I just ask one more question, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
In situations in which there is insurance and the real party in interest is the insurance company because insurance will cover the judgment, are you aware of cases in which the insurance company has decided to appeal a judgment against it, not necessarily for the benefit of their insured, but because an important point of insurance law is involved?
Well, absolutely, that happens.
And does this then measure who the real appellant is? Because we would be looking, let's say, an auto accident, and you've got person A versus person B, who maybe is simply doesn't even have anything except a $50,000 policy, may rent, have no equity in their car, virtually no assets. But the real issue is something that Allstate or State Farm or Geico or something has a real interest in. Would this get to the real appellant?
No, that's a very interesting question. I can't tell by reading this. I mean, I think they would, you know, obviously that's something that would be argued about. I think that the insurance company would argue you look at the person and not the insurance company. That shouldn't be the case, though, you know, because it's not the intent of this bill, I think, is to protect the idea that a business shouldn't have to go into bankruptcy in order to appeal a decision. So if that is the intent, then looking at the business instead of the insurer who's paying for the appeal would undermine the intent.
Because in no sense of the word is the insurance company either a named appellant or a named appellee, right?
Right. So they would look at the insured, the assets of the insured or the judgment against the insured, not the insurance company.
Thank
and that's what I think that's what would happen. It's not clear given this change in the rule, but I think that's what would happen. But I think it's okay. I think I answered your question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kaka.
Maybe she can answer this question. It is true that the insurance is the set for the bond, but the strict liability is on the appellate. Is that true?
You mean the strict liability to pay the judgment against them?
Yes.
That is true. If they're insured, typically they pay the judgment would only be to the amount that it's in, you know, they're insured, and if the judgment exceeds their amount.
She answered that question. So the next question then is.
I don't think she had finished her answer.
Representative Grunberg, Representative Coghill.
I would ask you to be allowed to finish your answer.
Ms. Simonian, did you finish the answer to Representative Coghill's question, and can you keep it concise?
The only thing I was going to add is that the insurance would cover, you know, typically insurance covers the amount of the judgment.
And Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, I thought you had finished.
That's okay.
I thought you were going to explain the explanation. So then the next question is, has it been true that a company has ever had to fight their insurance company to maintain what they've agreed on in this bonding requirement?
I'm not aware of a person having to fight their insurance company on that basis. I've personally never handled a case like that. I'm sure it exists.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just so that, because I'm trying to get this, the principle, I cannot duke it out all day long with trial lawyers. I just can't, civil lawyers. But I can find the principle that I'm trying to find here, and that is the matter of fairness. Do you think that it would be appropriate for somebody who is an appellate to go ahead and dissipate their assets?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So that's why this language is in here, because it would give the exception. And I'm trying to find out, is it the amount or the language itself that is so disturbing in this particular rule change?
The amount is disturbing. And the language about dissipating, I think, is good, important language. Its intent, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is to make sure that you don't have somebody who's lost trying to abuse the appellate process in order to get rid of their assets and avoid paying a judgment.
Right.
And that's the intent behind it. And I believe that, of course, is very important if you're going to make any kind of change to this rule. The problem is that there's no mechanism for making sure that that doesn't happen. And it puts the burden on the person who was awarded whatever for, a breach of contract, for a breach in a real estate sale, for fraud, for any, number of things. The person who was awarded by a jury a judgment, it puts the burden on them to prove that somebody is trying to, dissipate their assets in order to avoid paying something that at that point they owe.
Okay.
That's my concern. Yep. There's no mechanism for doing it. It adds another layer of litigation that would open up that company's net worth to the public and to the other side. And also, there's no realistic way to track that through the appellate process, because an appeal, I'm sure you're aware, takes many years. So it would make the person who won to basically watchdog and bird dog the person who lost and owes them money to ensure that they aren't trying to hide assets.
Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, isn't it true, though, and help me understand this, that during the appellate process, the judgment is in the hands of the court, and so would it be a separate trial, or would it be a part of that particular appeals process that a particular court would have charge of?
Well, typically, you're right. When a judgment is entered, the trial court is done, and the appellate court kicks in. And so you're appearing before the appellate court. But this change would require the parties to continue litigating in front of the trial court, as simultaneously litigating their appeal. So they would be making the appeal and making their arguments and doing the litigation that's involved in the appeal, but at the same time keeping the trial court busy, making sure that this, in some way, which I'm not really sure how, making sure that the party who is appealing isn't trying to hide or dissipate assets. So that's when I was saying it adds a whole other level or layer of litigation. And I think the Department of Law recognizes that in its fiscal note, that is what's going to be going on, because it's going to be using both the appellate court and the trial court simultaneously.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
So the A, B, and C, or the issue of between state and another governmental entity, the environmental disaster, and the intentionally dissipating, all become problematic because they're all in a very different discovery mode. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, it would essentially, and I think what Representative Gruenberg was getting at is that, you know, dissipating assets, you're not allowed to do that, period. And essentially, if it didn't have that exception in there, you would be able to file a lawsuit saying this, and this corporation is or company is committing fraud, fraudulent transfer of assets. But it's a difficult thing to prove because you have to have access basically to all of their financial information. And I think it was Representative Ramirez asked me, what aren't these people who are writing these letters in support getting? And I don't think they get that. I don't think they understand that by passing this bill, they're opening up their financial assets to the person they just litigated and lost against when they wouldn't necessarily have to. And I think in order to ensure that they aren't dissipating assets, that would have to be remain an open avenue of discovery throughout the appeal process, which, as I explained earlier, can take years.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Coghill.
The purpose that I brought this forward on was that an appeal that would immediately drive a company into bankruptcy. So it seemed appropriate to me to kind of head down this road of language. So, and still being somewhat sympathetic to those who won their case, but also protecting the right of appeal. I think what I was trying to do was say, let's lower the limit of appeal so that that's capable of doing, and then give these safeguards. What you're saying, these safeguards are in fact too intrusive to be even in fact safeguards.
I think the safeguards are intrusive, and I think that they are nearly impossible to be effective in the realm of litigation, because essentially what would have to happen is whoever won would have to take on the cause of becoming a watchdog against the company that lost. And so that would require the winner of the lawsuit to continue litigating in order to make sure that that company isn't hiding assets, basically, or continue litigating in order to determine whether $5 million or 10% of the company's net worth is the lesser of, you know, the lesser value that needs to be posted on appeal. So, you know, even best case scenario, this is going to add a significant layer of litigation any case.
Okay, Representative Coghill.
Thank you very much. I you're helping me out here a little bit. This is a world that I guess I've wandered into where we might say fools dare to. However, it just seemed fair to me to lessen the bond requirements, and so I was willing to go down into this road. Looking at what other states have done, they have probably done it in a simpler fashion. So if I wanted to go down that road and do it, then lessening the bond or putting a cap on the bond at a certain level and requiring them to perform, would that still be problematic in your idea, in your mind, even if whatever that number would be? I gave $5 million and 10%. But there are some, I think, that are just hard caps that I looked, probably $25 million in many, many states. But I don't know that I was trying to say for these smaller companies, even that could be significant. So I was trying to say 10% of the net value because of the grocery store or the business that picked up a partner that they ended up having to carry the full weight of. So can you give me some idea of, do you think that it should always be the value of the judgment, or is there some place for a cap?
Well, I think that the rule has built into it a mechanism for making sure that an unfair result doesn't occur. So, and which is what I think you're trying to do, because it gives the court discretion to change the amount of the bond. It doesn't have to be the amount of the judgment. It could be less than the amount of the judgment. if the company were to say to the court, we can't post that amount of bond because it would send us into bankruptcy, then it gives the court the discretion to decide whether or not, you know, less of a bond or, you know, I guess you could also say more of a bond is required. And that would be the court that has been the trial court and has, you know, been involved and knows the conduct and knows the result and knows, you know, even more than the jury knew about what went on in that case. So I think in that situation, it's already built in that unfair results shouldn't happen. Now, that's not to say that they don't. And I did read in some of the materials that you had compiled a few examples of in Alaska cases where I think it was the Valdez Fisheries nonprofit corporation and a Native corporation and another corporation. And it looked to me like in all of those situations, they again were either contract dispute or real estate disputes, not situations where, you know, a person is suing a small business type of situation. And I guess the problem with a hard cap, especially a hard cap as low as the one that you're proposing, is that it encourages frivolous appeals. Because if a corporation has the money to play the appeal game, they can appeal even if they really don't have meritorious, or if their meritorious appeal points aren't, you know, that they're marginally meritorious, it encourages them to appeal because they have nothing to lose. Appealing does, you know, it just makes the person who was wronged wait longer for the outcome of their case. And, I mean, we all know the best example of that, which I know I see you've written into your bill to avoid, is the Exxon Valdez situation. I mean, that's an example of, you know, playing the appellate game at the expense of the party who should have been compensated for 20 years. Now, that's a worst-case scenario type situation, but by changing the rule as it is, and it looks to me to be at the request of a national group, doesn't recognize really what Alaska, the problems faced by Alaskans. And I bring up the situation of the John Ellsworth versus Siri case because, you know, I think if you were to talk to either Siri or John Ellsworth, neither of them would wanted this to be in effect because, you know, it does add another level of litigation. When you add another level of litigation, regardless of whether it's a hard cap or not, when you add another level of litigation, both parties suffer because they have to pay more to litigate. And the party with the more money has the, you know, the advantage of pushing on more litigation because they can afford it. So I hope that answers your question.
That's very helpful, Megan. I want to remind the members, first of all, Representative Book has been here waiting with us patiently since we convened at 2. We also have Dylan Buchholz representing himself, Mike Schneider, another attorney representing himself. And then here in the room listening is Ann Johnson with the Department of Law. Available for questions is Emily Neenan with the American Cancer Society and Victor Schwartz, who testified last week with the American Cancer Society. Are there any members who have questions for Ms. Simonia?
I kind of wanted Representative Coghill to hear this, but I can go ahead anyway.
I'm sure.
Ms. Simonian, the normal practice to protect a debtor is the federal bankruptcy law. And a person who has a judgment is just a type of a creditor. They are a judgment creditor. And so here what we're seeking to do in this bill, I think the authors of the bill, the sponsors of the bill, are trying to seek some protection for debtors against other types of creditors. And a specific type of creditor. Whereas at the federal level, the recent Congress has sought to limit the type of protection debtors have under the Bankruptcy Act for credit card debt and all kinds of things. Isn't what this bill does kind of counter to the trend where creditors should be allowed to get the
their debts collected. Doesn't this run counter to that?
Oh, it absolutely does. And, I mean, it's counter to many of the trends. So that's the one point I was trying to make that maybe I didn't make clear, that, you know, it's also counter to the trend of trying to curb frivolous litigation, because it really encourages frivolous appeals.
If I may, on a second point here, we talk about protecting against, quote, intentional dissipation of assets, and we've kind of left that horse lying and bleeding on the side of the road. I'd like to go after another horse here. As well as doing that sort of thing, don't people who have judgments against them often delay, because the amount of post-judgment interest is far less than the amount they earn internally on the use of that money. And with respect to something we dealt with in the special session, Exxon has been found to earn about 21% on their money internally. Yet, under federal punitive damages statutes, they only pay about 3%. And in Alaska, under the post-judgment statute, I thought it's around 6 or 8%. But would this not encourage companies who aren't going to dissipate their assets at all simply to keep more of their assets so that they can internally earn more on them?
Well, that is exactly why I'm saying it would encourage frivolous appeals. There may be a calculus, you know, a company that's lost may decide, well, we don't really have much of a chance on appeal, but it's going to be better for us to tie this case up for another 4, 5, 6 years on appeal. Financially, it's better for us to tie this case up than it is to just pay the judgment now. So we'll go ahead and do that. And in the course of doing that, expend the public resources on dealing with the appeal and expend the public resources on dealing with the litigation to ensure, you know, that they're not dissipating their assets. So on both levels, it definitely will encourage companies to appeal a judgment, even if there isn't, because as you point out, it's more financially smart for them to do that than it is to just pay it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any follow-ups on?
I have one other thing. Are you familiar with Alaska Civil Rule 80, which allows personal folks and other people to post a bond so they don't have to even go to the expense of getting a corporate bond, how that would work in this circumstance?
You know, I've not thought about how that rule interplays with this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Gruber. We've handed that out to the members.
Next person to testify is Dylan Buchwald. Are you with us still, Dylan?
Can you hear me?
Yes, please identify your name and affiliation for the record, please. And then
yes, my name is Dylan Buchholz. I'm a lifelong resident of Anchorage, and I'm an attorney. I represent plaintiffs in personal injury claims, and this actual bill, I don't believe, really speaks to that level. But I'd like to echo a lot of what Ms. Simonian had to say, and she brought up scenarios that I had not considered, but. Bottom line is, you know, I was raised in Spinard, and we adhere strongly to the old maxim that if it ain't broken, don't fix it. And here, the whole process, the protections that we're seeking to keep the appellant and the appellee on an even playing field, they're built into the process as it is today. And any of these amendments or H. Bill 103 in particular, it tries too much where there isn't an issue. And I say that because in Alaska, only about 97% of all civil cases actually go to trial. Most settle well before trial, and certainly well before any type of bond requirements on appeal are brought into play. And of those 3%, I just don't see where there's any crisis where there's bankruptcies that are causing our economy or business people to fear the appellate process. If they have merit, they go forward. If they're if they're a company that stands on all fours, they go forward with their appellate process, and and I don't see any crisis that requires any type of change of the current rules that are in place. But even if you think that there is some sort of reason, some compelling reason to change the rules, let's talk a little bit about this so-called safety mechanism where you can have the full bond requirement reinstated if there's some sort of intentional dissipation of assets. Well, the problem with that, ladies and gentlemen, is that you won't know, unless you're an insider, whether or not the dissipation's occurred. There's no watchdog mechanism that can be put into place, and that's why the rules as they are today, that's the only solid, rock-solid way to make sure that the funds are available to protect those judgments. You could not ever anticipate what a business owner or a company or a board of directors will do and how fast that would go into effect. So the idea of trying to protect from dissipation of assets, the money would be gone before you even had a chance to assert a lawsuit in that regard. The counterpoint is it would force every appellee upon filing of the appeal under this new proposed rules. It would require that appellee to immediately file suit to try to protect their assets against any potential dissipation. And that's just adding to this litigation layer that I think everybody in the state would like to alleviate. And so I don't think that this attempted change makes much sense. Well, let's move on to the environmental disaster exception. Obviously, I think Ms. Simonia hit it on the head. This was put in as a direct result of what we've seen with Exxon Valdez, but it wouldn't stretch the imagination at all to come up with scenarios where there's much more egregious misconduct, negligence or otherwise, resulting in deaths, heinous injuries to people. That why wouldn't they qualify for an exception? Why does it have to take something that damages the environment and our economic well-being as a state, when families could certainly suffer catastrophic events that would be more tenable as far as these so-called exceptions? And finally, I guess it comes down to, again, who are we trying to protect here? I think that in most cases, what we are really talking about is an insurance company that's the real party in interest, and it comes down to, are we trying to make sure that the average man on the street and the average business person on the street is being protected, or are we trying to protect some nefarious corporate interest in the insurance industry? And I think that's probably how this was packaged to those organizations and letters of support that were discussed earlier. I think it's been packaged as a kind of a quasi-tort reform that's good for big business. And what's good for big business, I guess, would follow is good for little business. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's mispackaged. And I think that the only legitimate course is for the committee to table this and have the rule exist as written. And that's my testimony.
Thank you. No more questions from Representative Gruenberg. Have we heard from Mr. Schneider yet?
No.
Mr. Schneider, do you care to paint the barn?
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Tell us why this is such a bad piece of legislation. Proceed with your...
I will. My name is Mike Schneider. I practice law in this community for a pushing 33 years this summer. I think that this... And I'm assuming that the committee members have a copy of my letter of March 15th, 07 to Senator Huggins, addressing what at the time was an identical bill, SB 48. I'd like to join the comments of the prior two speakers. I'd like to make just a couple other points. Anytime human beings design a system, no matter how good it turns out, you will be able to find an instance or two every once in a blue moon where we could probably all agree the outcome wasn't perfectly fair. Maybe the outcome should have been different. And I think here, if you search the world over, you might find a situation where somebody had a pretty righteous point on appeal.
Mental consent bills.
Circumstances were such that they felt they couldn't pursue their righteous point on appeal, and they had to settle. or otherwise capitulate to the other side. But I simply submit that those are extremely rare instances, and this bill would have the effect of elevating what are really anomalies into the system. Into matters of huge importance, they really would cause us to take a system that works well as it is for everyone, and have it altered to address cases that are a few standard deviations away from the mean. I guess, you know, looking over this bill, the other thing that I want to make very clear to the committee is that I just think this is such terrible public policy, and it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. It doesn't really matter if you're a small business owner or a big business owner, because no matter what slot you enjoy, whether you're a personal injury plaintiff, whether you're a small contractor who's been done wrong by a supplier, whether you're a builder that's been done wrong by a contractor, whether you're the state of Alaska and someone's failed to perform in a major public work setting, no matter who you are or what you do, you can end up in litigation. And if you win at the trial court level, our system affords the loser another bite at the apple, and the only cost of that bite, by the way, we pay for that apple. The public pays for the court system and its appellate and the judges on the Supreme Court and the work that they do and their staff and their furnishings and their law clerks. The only thing you got to do is show your responsibility to pay what you have already been determined to owe. That's all you have to do. And as I believe it was Representative Gruenberg, just by listening to his voice, pointed out a moment ago, if you, and as Ms. Simonian pointed out, if you can't afford to do that, you can make your pitch to the trial judge, who has the discretion to cut you some slack. And, you know, I haven't agreed with every trial judge decision I've run into in 33 years, I can assure everyone. But, you know, trial judges may well grant a lower bond requirement in some instances, but boy, they probably aren't too likely to grant it where they think the defendant that got tagged at trial deserved what it or he or she got. So if you can't get by the trial judge, as Representative Gruenberg pointed out, you can go to federal court and get relief there. There just isn't any reason to change a system that is fair to all and keeps outfits like Exxon for tying people with legitimate claims up forever in court simply because they can make more money on the funds that they rightfully owe than they spend perpetuating the process. With that and with the comments in my letter, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. Do you, Mr. Schneider, do you have a copy of the E version, the proposed CS?
I suspect that I do not. I was out of town for a week. I started finding out about this on Saturday, and what I was able to print is the A version.
Well, okay. Let's take that. There are really two different sections in the bill that we're concerned about. The first is at the Superior Court level, trial court level, stay on appeal, Rule 65, 62, and the other is the supersedious bond on Appellate Rule 204. Now, the version you have, if you would look at page 3, line 6.
Got it.
It says intentionally dissipating assets. Now, on the CS, that word intentionally no longer appears. However, if you look in your version on page 4, line 5, it says dissipating. Now, the CS
has the word intentionally dissipating on page 3, line 15.
That'd be a bad idea.
Yep.
And let me just point out, as I believe that I did in my letter that you should all have a copy of, first of all, I've never been in this spot. I'm kind of in the odd position, I believe, today, advocating for business and corporate interests of virtually any size who find themselves caught in litigation and need to collect on their righteous claims. Frankly, that's work I don't do much of. But after you win one of these cases, the discovery show is over. How do I go figure out whether the outfit that I've got the judgment against is dissipating assets or not? And if in light of a rule change like this, the court granted me the leeway to go look into that, let's just remember that attorney's time costs money and it takes resources. Why should a client who's won a trial, why should they have to pay me and pay my forensic CPA consultant to go basically monitor the business conduct of my opponent to make sure that they aren't divesting themselves of assets? I mean, it's more frivolous litigation. And who does it protect? It protects entities that have already been determined after trial to be responsible to pay a sum of money and who are currently allowed to appeal to the Supreme Court so long as they do no more than illustrate and bond their ability to pay at the end.
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt and move this thing along quickly?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll remind you, Representative Lindbergh, that it's one of the members of your minority caucus whose bill's about to get bumped to Wednesday because of your lengthy Q&A of the attorneys.
No, it's because the bill was introduced.
Point made.
And we have a great member of the minority, I might say. Now, under the current rule, the amount of the bond, the supersedious bond, is the amount of the judgment.
Correct.
Plus the costs on appeal.
Correct.
Plus interest.
Correct.
That's the normal amount. However, the amount under this rule that they'd have to put up would only be the amount of the judgment. About how much, what percentage short of the actual damage would that be? We're talking about no interest, no costs, et cetera.
Well, it varies. That would vary year to year as a function of the post-judgment interest rate. But given the time of a run-of-the-mill appeal and given the way those interest rates have been running, you're talking about 15 to 20% shy of the mark.
Okay. And secondly, how will you know when you have to prove about the dissipating assets whether or not it's, quote, outside the ordinary course of business, unquote?
Well, that be a difficult, you know, that's like how many legal fairies can dance on the head of a pin, and how much resources should a righteous claimant have to, whether it's a business or the state of Alaska or whoever, how much effort should they have to spend doing that to protect their position? The current system protects their position, and that's why it shouldn't be altered.
Thank you. No further questions.
Are there any additional questions for Mr. Schneider? Mr. Schwartz, are you on the line? Is Mr. Schwartz on the line?
Mr. Schwartz. Hello.
Mr. Schwartz, we've got just a couple of minutes. Would you care to rebut Mr. Buchholz, Mr. Schneider, and Ms. Simonian before we set this bill aside for today?
In 2 minutes.
Through the chair, yes. I'd like to make a few comments very quickly.
Thank you.
First, I love plaintiff's attorneys. I was one, but when I hear plaintiff's attorneys say they're there to protect business, it's like a landlord saying they're there to protect tenants. Let me just go to the issues. One of the witnesses, there's nothing to lose by taking an appeal. That's not true. If a bond cap is $5 million, or I understand someone is suggesting it would be $25 million, that is a significant amount of money. And before one wants to post such a bond, one must think very carefully. There's no free ride here. Second, there are 37 states that have this law. Some have had it for a significant period of time. None of these events or hypotheticals that were put forward have we at ALEC heard of. And the ALEC members, the American Legislative Exchange Council members, when they put forth a bill, if there is a problem with that bill, we hear about it. So there, the problems that were talked about litigation within litigation, have not arisen because in most instances when this arises, there's a very, very substantial judgment. The defendant is a company that's a public company. There is no real issue as to whether it will dissipate assets. So there's no litigation within a litigation all the time. So those are just a few points. Finally, the point made that 97% of the cases are settled. That's true in other states, too. What we're really talking about are cases where a judge has made a significant error. The jury, perhaps, in a particular situation was not well guarded or well instructed. And the defendant believes that they have a right to appeal, and this bonding cap, whatever you mount, you fix it, helps assure that appeal. And the Supreme Court has never had a holding on this, but certainly if you go in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, it suggests that the right to appeal is a very important one, especially for unpopular defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Are there questions for Mr. Schwartz? Is there anybody else in the room or online that wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing such public testimony is closed at the request of the bill sponsor, Representative Samuels.
Before we get to there, did Emily Neenan come back online?
Ms. Neenan?
Yes.
Hi, Ms. Neenan. Representative Samuels has a question for you.
Yeah, hi, Emily. On page 3 of the bill, I'm assuming that you were looking here.
You have to identify yourself, please.
Yes, Ms. Neenan, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, this is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I apparently have a morbid curiosity in the goings-on of House Judiciary.
that's sick.
Oh, well said.
Wow. In previous years, there's been a move on the appeal bond issue, more geared towards the master settlement agreement and dealing solely with tobacco companies. But on page 3, letter A, line 6 and 7, and awards and actions and proceedings which the state or another governmental entity is a party, that when I read that, it seemed that that was the way to get away from the issue of big tobacco and their appeal bonds, which was an issue 3 or 4 years ago. And I'm just wondering if you had an opinion on that.
I haven't seen the current draft of the bill. I don't have that version. I only have the A version.
Okay. If you could take a look at that, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Is she looking or is...
No, I'm not looking. I don't have it.
Oh, okay. I understand.
I would love to see it, and I will definitely take a look at it.
All right. Well, we will at this point close public testimony. We will set this bill aside. It's 5 minutes after 3. Let me query the members because we only have 5 members here. Do the members have time to take up House Bill 278, Representative Book's bill? What is?
Do I like it?
We're going to lose Representative Dahlstrom. We've already lost Representative Coghill. Where were we with 278? We had closed public testimony. We had brought it back to the committee. We were contemplating 2 specific amendments. So you, Representative Book, if you could come up here swiftly.
We're on the E version.
That's correct. We're on the E version. You generated a legal opinion for us. We have Kathy Monfreda, David Shade with Public Safety available for questions, as well as Detective Sergeant Tidler from Anchorage Police Department available for questions. It seems that we had two issues that were before us. One was the query I had, which is whether we could identify people by their handles. You had a legal opinion drafted that indicated that that was not the case. And the second one was a definition of the phrase Internet communication identifier. And then I see we also have an amendment by Representative Holmes. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Chairman Ramirez, this is Representative Bob Book from District 27, mm-hmm. stating that is correct. And would offer up the suggestions from Committee Member Holmes, if she has any at this point.
Representative Holmes, would you, before we take up Amendment Number 1, would you just discuss what it encompasses, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The proposed amendment, I believe, is aimed at addressing one of the questions from last meeting, which was trying to figure out what the online identifier meant. And this simply fleshes out that it means, and looking at page 2, line 5, online identifier means any electronic mail address information or instant message, chat, social networking, or other similar internet communication name, but does not include a social security number, date of birth, or PIN number. I believe most of the rest of this is conforming. The bill sponsor could maybe help flesh that as well. But that is my intention. Okay.
Representative Book?
These were in response to Representative Coghill's questions, and we patterned this after Arizona's registration law, which gave the clarity there, and I do appreciate the amendment being offered, and that is the explanation.
All right, you're very welcome. Public testimony is closed. We have House Bill 278 before us. Do the members have any comments before the chair would entertain an amendment? Seeing no comments, the chair will entertain an amendment. Representative Dahlstrom?
An amendment or motion?
An amendment.
Oh, I apologize.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Amendment Number 1, which is 25 LS1104/E.2.
Okay. Are there any objections to Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. That addresses the Internet communication identifier. And the other issue we addressed, and we'll look at taking that up as legislation in the interim. Are there any other amendments or issues before the committee? Seeing none, the chair would invite a motion. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 78.
275.
25-LS1104/E with amendment number 1, attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objections, CS for House Bill 278 passes from committee. It's 5 after 3, and we're adjourned.